We believe that good is something positive. Yet we are not too sure exactly what good is. What is true, absolute, abstract goodness? Not being very certain as to what is good, we must try to philosophize on it a little bit. Of all religions, good may be considered under several different types of thinking. If the word good is capitalized, it generally is a synonym for God. And Socrates divided the basic triad of primary nature or primary being into the one, the beautiful, and the good. Good, therefore, stands for absolute virtue. It stands for absolute integrity, for all the things which are best, for all conditions, powers, forces, and circumstances that arise in the best and perpetuate the best, or move inevitably toward the accomplishment of that which is best. Not capitalized, good means the condition of being without sin. It means to be abundant in the natural, simple virtues of mankind. So we have commandments given to us, like the Decalogue, by which the measurement of the good life is more or less created into a code or a system. We are given certain commandments, and the commandments of the Old Testament are amplified by the two of the New Testament. So that the final commandments, perhaps, for Christendom are that we shall love God with all our hearts and our brothers as ourselves. These constitute the highest concept of the good life. The good life is the useful life, the unselfish life, the kind life, the generous, sympathetic, understanding life. The good life is one in which the person becomes a source of good to others, defending good, advancing it, supporting it, and protecting it. A good life is also one in which the person can look back upon a life in which his own conscience has not been outraged by his conduct. He knows he will not be and cannot be perfect, but a good life is one in which he feels that the good things he has done overbalance the mistakes that he has made. Where this is the case, the pious person of old felt that he might face his Maker with a good heart and a good hope. Goodness also has to do with common good, with laws, with statutes, with institutions established for the improvement and betterment of mankind. Good is peace, order, lawfulness. Good is community existence on a cooperative basis. Good represents also security for the individual, his family, his world. And it is assumed that where we live in a generation of comparative peace, where our industry is reasonably rewarded, where we have the security of a quiet private life, held within the common social bounds of decency, that these are good times in which to live. Now, there are some who are more interested in active attitudes and estimations. To them, good is progress. To them, good is anything which makes life better for man. So good brings into its fold creative artistry, science, medicine, law, engineering, everything that may be regarded as contributing to the security and improvement of mankind as a whole. So we can think of good as all that helps, and we can think of it as beginning with the divine all which helps everything, and come down to the private type of help which we can bestow upon each other. The good man is therefore an honest man who pays his bills, whose word is his bond, who lives charitably and generously, who is a friend to his friend, who has no enemies, and who practices the benevolences regarded as essential by his religion. If he is not a religious person, as may be the case today, he may also achieve a certain measure of good. He then lives ethically, lives morally, lives creatively within the span of good taste, within the pattern of that which is obviously the common good. And he can still have all the benevolences and ideals of popular service and public welfare, whether he be strongly religious or not. But it is more difficult for him, perhaps, to sustain himself in critical periods if he has no sense of eternal value locked within his own consciousness. Now, as opposed to this good, we have all that we may consider to be evil. Evil is not something that is absolutely and clearly distinct from good. Evil is as though it were a shadow cast by good. As soon as man attempts something creative, something idealistic, the adversary seems to rise out of nature to oppose him. The person, therefore, who tries to be better than his time is penalized by his time. The individual who tries to be honorable among those less honorable will again be paralyzed, exploited, and hurt. The person who tries to live a gentle, kindly Christian life in these days will be subjected to constant pressure, will be forced to compromise his principles, or else experience many kinds of failures and reverses. So it will appear in some mysterious way that good and evil are linked together. The individual who does not attempt to be better seldom experiences the pressures that come to those who make a legitimate and honorable claim to integrity. It would appear then also that good contains within it always the possibility of its own abuse. And what we call evil must be considered in this light. Most philosophy and many of the more enlightened religions of antiquity simply rejected empirically the existence of an evil principle in the universe. They refused to believe that a deity could at the same time be supreme and be the victim of the conspiracy of an adversary. This question was brought to Buddha on one occasion by the Brahmins, who tried to trick him into a commitment, much as the Pharisees tried to commit Jesus to a statement on the head on Caesar's penny. The answer that Buddha gave to the question as to whether deity permits good and evil to exist, whether deity is the source of both good and evil. Buddha answered very simply, if God does not prevent evil, he is not good. If God cannot prevent evil, he is not God. And the Brahmins went away and could not answer him. And this is very largely the philosophic point of view in both the East and West, that the concept of a supreme principle must imply that this principle is good. We cannot join a few like the Yazids of Iraq who settled down to the quiet process of devil worship. We cannot afford in our own consciousness to assume that the universe is governed by evil. But we must assume that the universe is governed by something. And whatever that something is, it cannot be divided against itself. The universe cannot be maintained unless there is a supreme power that guides its ultimate destiny. The house divided against itself cannot stand, and a creation divided against itself could not survive as this has for uncounted billions of years. I don't mean the earth, I mean the vast pageantry of existence. Consequently, all thoughtful, all wise and kindly people have come finally to the conclusion that the universe is essentially the production of what we would like to term good. Here, perhaps, however, we have made a mistake. We have taken two terms which oppose each other and assisted the balance or caused the situation by applying one of these terms to a supreme power, which in this way almost forces us to attribute the other term to a power of equal magnitude. So the philosophers finally came to the conclusion that good and evil, as we use these terms, are both of them inadequate to express the nature of the original state of being. The universe was therefore regarded as a state of existence. This existence, superior to both good and evil as we know these terms. This existence, subsisting forever according to its own nature. This nature being absolute and infinite. This nature has to be lawful, has to be all-powerful and inevitable. And the manifestation of this power cannot be polarized in its basic existence. This power must be one inevitable, immutable reality. This reality, however, is known to us by means of a comparative faculty within our own natures. This comparative faculty being established in the mind, or being more or less the mental life of man. Research indicates that man, developing a mental life, can only do so by the use of a polarized concept. Man must think in the either-or patterns. He may attempt to develop a non-Aristotelian theory, but ultimately he comes back to comparison. Man compares. And the concept of good and evil, therefore, as we know it, has to arise in man. It has to arise in the very creature that has found words to express it. And in every language, man has found words to express the concept of good and evil. Man, however, has no absolute knowledge of either. He cannot positively define absolute good, nor absolute evil. He cannot know with complete certainty whether any incident that occurs to him is good or evil. He thinks he can. But every so often, his best interpretations prove to be inadequate. The man who stands on the railroad platform cursing his ill luck at having missed the train does not know that the train will be wrecked, and the fact that he missed it was the most fortunate thing that could happen to him. It is only later that what he regarded as a minor disaster proved to be a great blessing. There are occasions every day in which we are forced to revise our own interpretations of things. So perhaps we can go back to the Greeks and also to the Egyptians, who finally came to the conclusion that good and evil are man's ways of attempting to define the impact of infinite life upon himself. It's the same problem with the stars. Are there evil stars? Are there good or evil aspects? Or are these very highly speculative terms? Man unable to know the infinite in its own nature, except perhaps a few very highly illuminated mystics who have gone a little further than the average mortal in this research. For the most part, man's idea of good and evil is all based upon certain reactions which arise in himself. Now, it is true that men can be better or worse, that we cannot say that good and evil necessarily exclusively arise within the person, but they do arise within the collective, which we call humanity itself. We cannot term natural phenomena actually either good or evil in itself, any more than we can determine the moral quality of the divine will. Natural occurrences arise of themselves. They have to be accepted. But the fact that they arise does not make them good or evil. Because to be good or evil, the storm would have to have the choice. The storm would have to choose to be a storm, which is not true. Therefore, the minglings and chemistries of nature cannot be determined by the code of good or evil. We deny the right of good or evil to any creature without a mind. Consequently, we cannot imagine our little dog as a sinner because he bites the postman. It is bad judgment, bad taste, and perhaps bad flavor. But at the same time, the dog cannot be held guilty of sin. But we do not recognize that the animal is capable of moral decision. It is the follower of natural instincts of its own kind. Men have injured animals for ages, and animals fear man as a result. So that this cannot be held to be a true evidence of good and evil. What we are really saying is, therefore, that good and evil cannot exist unless the being in which they arise is capable of reacting to either. An individual cannot be good unless he has chosen to be good in the presence of an opportunity not to be good. An individual cannot be evil unless in the presence of choice between good and evil, he has chosen evil. It is his choice, therefore, voluntarily made, which causes him to have merit or demerit. In the same way, we do not consider small children accountable to law, because until we regard them as old enough to understand, we cannot hold them guilty of action. Thus, the problem of good and evil lies in understanding. It lies in some recognition by which the being, supported in his choice by at least a limited individualism, a capability for choice, this individual must choose, and by his choice he is good or bad. If this is true, then what is the relationship of good and bad to the universe itself? The answer is that there is no essential relationship, that good and bad simply arise in conditioned existence. If there was no man or no other creature possessing faculties of decision in the universe, then good and bad could not exist. But if there is a creature arising anywhere in whom these faculties are developed, then when that creature reaches a point of self-determinism, good and bad are simultaneously launched upon his awareness. There we can then come perhaps a little to the Oriental point of view, that in these things, man is casting the reflection of himself upon space. Man talks of a good God and an evil agent, a demon. What he is actually doing, however, is projecting his own dual nature upon space and insisting that space itself is the source of his duality. Is this essentially true? Is space responsible for the good-bad condition that we know? The ancients did not feel so. They thought that good-bad were matters of adjustment, that good and bad had to do with ways of interpreting the inevitable processes of life. The individual passing through certain experiences himself found his pleasures or his pains from these experiences. If these experiences pleased him, he considered them good. If they displeased him, he considered them evil. Yet in the very process of seeking his own pleasures, he fell into most of his own pain. The very process, therefore, of seeking good in terms of gratification led to misery. Thus happiness and unhappiness, as Buddhism points out, must always be related to each other. The individual cannot indulge any excess of mind or emotion without reaction. Thus, theoretically in philosophy, good can be considered action, and evil a reaction to an action, which is not adequate, which is not sufficient. If the action is sufficient, if the action carries within it no ill factor, then the consequences can also be good. Therefore, good as consequence arises from good. Evil as consequence arises from the corruption of good. Another way of looking at it was advanced by some of the early Sabians and people in the valley of the Euphrates. They took the attitude that there was a great cord or thread, like a musical string, uniting heaven and earth. It was divided into various intervals, and these were marked like the frets of a stringed instrument. And in this sequence of considerations, the thread extended from good to bad. And bad, in this case, was always one thing only, the least degree of good. We only had one thing. Evil, therefore, could be regarded as an ineffective degree of good, a degree of good that was not enough to accomplish very much. Evil as darkness was held by some people to be the least degree of light. As good can be regarded as the greatest degree of a thing, so the least degree of that same thing, if it be essential or necessary, can be regarded as evil. This was one other way of trying to solve the problem. Good and evil also arise out of relationships. The individual in the desert is very anxious to have water. To him, water is the greatest good. To the drowning man, water is the greatest possible evil, unless he learns to swim at the critical moment. Thus, good and evil relate to situations. And all over the world today, there are people engaged in various activities. For them, these activities seem good. For another person, these activities do not seem good. The quiet person who has no particular desire to take on heavy responsibilities chooses a job in which routine activity will be his most common probability. This man is happy and satisfied in his work. An ambitious man captured in the same type of employment will become embittered, restless, and rebellious. Good, therefore, is that which produces satisfaction in the life itself. And we cannot judge one man's good entirely by the good of other people. This is one of our common daily difficulties, is that we are all trying to help other people to be happy by helping them to be the way we think they should be. We want them to share a happiness that we have found, but when we force it upon them, they are miserable, because it is not their kind of happiness. Good also must be regarded as a term highly relative in relation to the changing patterns of civilization. Many things that were considered good long ago are no longer considered good. Things that were regarded as evil 50 years ago are now accepted as commonplace and not to be the cause of very much unhappiness or worry. In the Middle Ages, a man was good if he drew his sword quickly and killed the other man first. If he did not accept the challenge to a duel, he was not good. He was a coward. He lost all community standing. Today, this is no longer the case. In different periods of time, various values men have sought after have been regarded as the greatest good. Even today, there are millions of human beings industriously striving after various good things that are meaningful to them. Others have no share in this meaning, and each feels that others are wasting their time. So good becomes a fulfillment of our own natures, that which brings to us the greatest sense of achievement, of accomplishment, of integrity. These are decisions that the person has to make in himself, for we have learned that there is no very common rule that we can apply to all of them. Thus we can approach perhaps good now in a still more philosophic way to try to understand the problem of good and evil. Suppose we affirm for the moment that the universe is right. There are people who are reluctant to do this, but they've never been able to make a very good case to the contrary. But assuming for the moment that the universe is essentially right, that the power, whatever it may be, that regulates the universe is essentially a proper power, that the universe, having been created by a power capable of creating it, and being maintained by that power, which is obviously capable of maintaining it, that this universal project, so to say, being under the dominion of an absolute authority, that the moral issue rests as to the integrity of that absolute authority. Most persons have assumed that absolute authority to be God. And this God is therefore the highest possible quality of being, a being which is perfect in all qualities, attributes, conceivable and beyond human conception. That this power is deficient in nothing. And this power must also possess within itself the envisionment of purpose. Whatever it is that exists, either exists for a reason or for no reason. If it arises within the nature of an omniscient being, then this plan of things, so slowly, industriously, arduously projected through time and space, this incredible unfoldment of existence beyond even the imagination of the greatest astronomer or physicist, this tremendous project must arise from some power capable of causing it. Even if we wish to assume that this process is continuous forever, then the continuing forever process has to have these attributes. And there is no reason to assume, even by the most materialistic sophistication, that the power that is capable of creating so vast and magnificent a projection, that this power is not also purposed or purposeful in some way. This massive production has to be going somewhere. It is inconceivable to assume that any power intelligent enough to create this pattern would at the same time permit it to die out in space in complete futility. We cannot assume that this creating power is merely a child fashioning something in a sandbox of atoms. There seems to be every indication that whatever this power is far wiser than we are, and man has never been slow to advance the merits of his own wisdom. So how can we assume that deity can be completely without purpose? Now, if we assume purpose, we are forced to assume that purpose is achieved through process. Everything that is happening in some way in relation to the fulfillment of purpose. If this entire structure, down to the smallest electron, is in a perfect harmonic pattern, held together by irrefutable and unbreakable laws, then we must have progress, process, unfoldment, ideation, evolution, whatever we want to call it. This tremendous pattern is moving from somewhere to somewhere. It is moving from something to something. It is moving from some condition to some other condition. We can observe this motion in part. Enough of it, however, to give us considerable security in affirming that there is more of this same motion. This means that if we are willing to accept that this plan indicates some kind of sovereign intelligence, that this sovereign intelligence knows what it is doing. In the Hindu thinking, of course, this sovereign intelligence fills all space as Brahma. It extends to the ultimate duration of time and eternity. The infinite absolute, which contains the entire galaxy of all conceivable created systems in space. This incredible immensity permeates all existence with its own nature. And this is its own nature is life, law, intellect, energy. It's this tremendous nature is the source of the infinite variety of manifestations that arise within it. Now, if this nature is the absolute and is the ultimate creating power carried to infinity, if this nature is sufficient in itself, inevitable and immutable of itself, the creator of its own laws, and at the same time is unique, being the only of itself that can exist, then it becomes reasonably obvious that this power will not create an archenemy. This power with a purpose is not going to fashion a frustration for that purpose. There is no need for it. There is no conception that requires it. There is nothing in the processes of nature that reveal that this happened. Actually, it is impossible, as the Hindu really tells us, for there to be a hell within the body of God. And as there is nothing outside of the body of God, and every creature that exists is part of deity, the concept of damnation must mean that deity damns himself. And this is not conceivable. The second alternative to this is that the universe, with all the attributes which we have already mentioned, does not rise from a being, but arises from a complex of forces, of energies, that the source of the existence is not an entity, but a process itself. This, however, changes none of the inevitable dependencies upon this process. Whether we wish to consider deity to be a being, or to be an infinite energy, or an infinite mind, or an infinite life without personalized or individualized existence, we are still in exactly the same position. For whatever this is obviously capable of an orderly procedure, a purposeful procedure, a procedure arising in processes, and a procedure that must lead ultimately to the survival of the energies which are involved in it. We then come to the same essential point again. The basic realization that behind all existence there has to be purpose, there has to be plan, there has to be some kind of an unfoldment or an ideation or a projection or a motion in time from past to future, and this motion has to be orderly. It is orderly, it always has been. To have this basic concept leaves us then no moral choice but to assume that whatever this power is right because it is inevitable. Right now simply stands for obedience to the pattern, whatever this pattern may be. There can be no right contrary to the eternal purpose. For anything that is contrary to an eternal purpose must ultimately be destroyed, or must be in some way modified, changed, reformed, or reconditioned by that purpose itself. To carry this one step further, then, this right, which we sense as existing, which perhaps the scientist is in the best position to understand, because he is working with exactitudes all the time. This right we can call an exactitude. We can also say that certain laws, once noticed, and considered, examined, researched, may be known to proceed according to their own natures to infinity. There is no evidence that these laws suddenly change their minds. So that we have the basic concept here that this infinite purpose, whatever it may be, has to be right because there can be no other purpose. We cannot rebel and walk out of it because there is no place to go. If we walk forever, we could never reach the end of this purpose, this plan. If we had all the spaceships in time and imagination and could go on for millions of light years into infinity, we would still not escape any part of this essential plan. We cannot defy it, because no gnat floating in a sunbeam can defy the sun itself. We cannot in any way create an adequate conspiracy against it, because if we could unite all the wits of 10,000 solar systems, it would mean nothing. Whatever this thing is. And because this thing that is also the very center and substance of ourselves, all rebellion against it is merely intellectual will-gathering. There can be no rebellion. This thing, then, whatever this pattern must be and is, has to be right by its own absolute autocracy. It is not a government that we can overthrow. It is not a government which we can attack or assail. There's no use picketing it. There's nothing we can do about it. And we have never yet discovered that there was any need to do anything about it. This government has never been an obviously oppressive autocracy. It has never done anything, as far as we really know, to hurt us. And there are no theologies that will stand up and declare that God has injured anything. So there seems to be no particular way in which we can get out of the fact that rightness is demonstrated eternally by the archetype or pattern of existence as it is. This leaves creation in a situation in which assuredly any natural process has to be according to right. It has to be according to law of some kind. Not man-made, but universal law. And universal law is the will of the plan asserting itself. And by means of universal law, the creation is governed as by a great legislative system. The answer then also presents itself is that this lawfulness has to be the final symbol of right. Now, having a right that exists in a condition in which there is no wrong, because this particular kind of right has no shadow, it has no negative polarity. This right is an infinitely and forever unfolding process. If this right is, therefore, lawful, eternal, inevitable, and if its motions will continue for hundreds of billions of years unchanging in their resolution to attain their own ends, then it must inevitably follow that if this rightness is right, its objectives are right, and its processes are right. We have no evidence whatever that this right will use evil means to attain right ends. We have no reason to assume that this right assumes that the ends justify the means, and therefore require any compromise of principles. We have to assume that the infinite, as deity, as truth, as reality, as integrity, must be forever honorable. Under such conditions, can anything that is wrong, can anything that is essentially bad happen? This is a very large question. For if anything bad can happen, then we have to assume that there is a contrary force, having a vitality and nature of its own, which can resist the operations of the universal agent. Most philosophical systems decline to accept this. A few religions have, but the great moral systems have not been willing to regard such a probability. Rather, they have taken this position, that in the unfoldment of this universal plan, an infinite variety of lives have emerged from the great seed life, which is the totality. These lives are in various degrees of growth and development. These lives represent parts and fragments of this greater life. But this greater life does not come into manifestation all at once. We're not sure that the great pattern of things has even been revealed in space as yet. We are somewhat inclined to suspect that this pattern is growing. That whether we believe it or not, space is constantly enlarging in some mysterious superdimensional way. Therefore, that this infinite being moves into expression through a series of waves, a series of great releases of life, which are periodically released all through space. just as the seasons produce various kinds of flowers and plants. And for all these there is a period of seed, of growth, of blossom, and of fruit. So in space, there is a constant coming forth of existences. And these existences represent various degrees of the revelation of the original life pattern. In Dante and Yoga and other Eastern systems of philosophy, and also among the Greeks, it was assumed that these seed lives, becoming embodied, must evolve through embodiment. Part of nature's program is the evolution of the species. We see this evolution in part around us in the growth and development of the mineral, vegetable, animal, and human kingdoms. We do not assume for a moment that these are all the kingdoms, but they are all that our own perceptions make possible for us to understand. We therefore assume that these kingdoms are ladders, and that these ladders in turn represent degrees of revelation or revealment of submerged life principles. That in these various creations, the life seed is unfolding in various degrees. And that as these lives unfold, they gain various attributes. Until in man, we have the maximum number of these revealed attributes. Man is capable, therefore, of existing as a mineral, a vegetable, an animal, and a human being. As a mineral, he has a physical body, as the mineral has. As a plant, he has growth and reproduction. As an animal, he has emotion and sense. And as a human being, he has intellect. Thus, man has achieved a certain degree of unfoldment. This degree of unfoldment, however, is not complete. This degree of unfoldment is as yet imperfect. And in the course of his own imperfect unfoldment, he is struggling to gain control of the various instruments which evolution is providing. Why evolution provides these instruments and what their ultimate intention is can only be estimated in an abstract way. We can assume, however, that these bodies, faculties, powers, and perceptions of man have a continuing existence in space, and that perhaps long after he has outgrown the need for them, that other forms of life will require them. But man passing through these various levels or degrees of unfoldment comes into various degrees of intelligence. It is not proper to say, perhaps, that the lesser kingdoms are devoid of intelligence. There is a great deal of evidence that even the most humble forms of life do have some kind of psychic existence. Nor is there any reason to assume that any of these lesser forms feel themselves underprivileged. Each is fulfilling its own destiny with the degree of consciousness which it possesses, and for each of them the universe is as large as can be properly conceived of by that particular form of life. So we come now to man, who exists as a partly evolved creature in the midst of this vast structure. He is more aware, probably, of this structure than any of the lesser kingdoms, at least of its outer nature. It is quite possible that these other kingdoms are more aware of its inner nature. Perhaps intuitively they perceive more than man does. But man, moving bluntly into objective relationship with things, perceives the universe around him and senses his own relationship to it in part. Now, man in his own development has developed this psychomental organism. It was necessary for him to do so. This is part of his natural growth. But at various levels in growth, we come upon the inconveniences of growing. Children experience these. It is no fun to simply grow up in this world anymore, from infancy to adulthood. It is full of pressures and problems. And man in his larger growing up process passes through infancy, childhood, adolescence, young maturity, and finally perhaps a fuller maturity. But these processes of growth all require adjustment. And man's evolution requires perpetual adjustment between himself and the pattern in which he exists. Just as young people are rebellious against society, so man in his evolution passes through these periods of rebellion. Rebellion which arises from his own sense of maturing intellect, coming in conflict with the real purposes of existence. Buddha therefore tells us that we have taken this tremendous plan, which we do not understand, and we have tried to interpret it. We had to try because this very plan is in us. We have to try because we have part of the energy of the plan striving within ourselves to reach out and grasp its own import. But we are seriously handicapped. Our growth is not yet sufficient to bring us into the adjustment which we want. We are growing in a perfectly natural and completely uncomfortable way, which is the way it was intended. Man, however, has in some instances been unnecessarily opaque in his attitudes. He has made mistakes that he did not need to make. He has made them because of the conflict between the sense of destiny in himself and the inability to release this sense of destiny in a reasonable concept within himself. Man senses his relationship to the infinite, but he is unable to make this sensing take on a fully rational characteristic. He just does not have, as yet, the skill to do it with. Man, therefore, not understanding and being a little too proud to admit this, set up in the very beginning of his existence certain rules, certain attitudes, certain plans, certain patterns for himself. We have to realize that he did this at the worst possible time. It would be like asking a newborn babe to decide on what college it's going to. Man was set in certain patterns before he had the realization to know what these patterns meant. And drifting down through time, he has permitted himself to preserve or perpetuate these patterns. He has never had quite the courage to break them. He has never been willing to admit basic error and seek for a reorganization of his relationships with the infinite. Gradually, out of his own arrogance, so to say, out of his own perpetual adolescence, out of the inevitable spirit of the beatnik that has been in him since the beginning, man has decided that he was qualified to take over the universe, that he was qualified to interpret it, that he was qualified to say whether there was a God or whether there was not a God. And he even went so far as to think that his affirmation or denial of deity had any effect whatsoever. He decided that if he wished to relegate deity to limbo, deity was going to go there. But the man who was constantly doing the relegating was the one who landed in limbo. As far as we can find out, deity was never much affected by any of this. As an old American Indian said, the moon is not disturbed by the baying of wolves. And this is much our problem. We have taken the universe apart, put it together again, intellectually at least, to our own satisfaction. And like the autopsy surgeon, we've never found a soul in it. Therefore, we assume there isn't any. We assume all these things. So we then decide in our own way just what kind of a universe we are willing to live in and start issuing ultimata. We set up our own patterns of education, our patterns of government,
our arts and our sciences. We declare what is good and what is bad, what is truth and what is error. And we create great man-made institutions to perpetuate, strengthen, and preserve our own opinions. Out of all this tremendous energy that we have expended in the process of taking over the rulership of things, we have come into this conflict with existence, which we call the struggle of good and evil. Good and evil, therefore, is nothing more or less than man's own relationship to things that never change. Man, having ambitions, calls any natural force that frustrates these ambitions evil. It has no bearing upon the fact of the matter. The individual then says that he wants to be comfortable and happy. Anything that makes him uncomfortable or unhappy is evil. Furthermore, he can see no reason why it would be permitted, and if he ran the universe, he would take care of it immediately. But he doesn't run the universe, so the thing goes on just exactly as it did before. The problem that faced Buddha in his philosophy was therefore not to explain why man was right, or go into a lengthy and elaborate debate as to which men were the most right. His great problem was to prove that the universe was right. And in order to prove the universe was right, he had to prove that the universe was without error in its own structure. That everything that happened had to be right. In this way, and this way only, could he get away from the conflict of good and evil. If things are right as they are, whether we like it or not, we are no longer required, therefore, to assume that what we do not like is evil. All we have to do is to recognize the unfoldment of a great merit system in space. So Buddha advanced the concept of karma as the solution to punishment and reward. The concept of karma was a law recognized as existing in space. God did not reward. Devils did not punish. Act rewarded and punished itself according to its own nature. And the fact that act did punish and reward itself was a supreme proof of good, if we want to assume the polarity of good at the moment. Evil would be if these laws did not operate. And as they do operate, and always have, and so far as we can imagine, always will, there can be no evil, because evil would be unlawfulness. It would be contrary to the plan. It would be rebellion against the infinite. And everything that occurs around man is not rebellion, but fulfillment.